You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 1st of July 2022 on Monocle 24.
What can Greece teach the NATO military alliance about Turkey? What can American cities teach us about tackling climate change? And would you pay to spend a day in Venice? I'm Chris Termack. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you live from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Termack. It is our in-house Friday Daily today. Chiara Ramella and Alexis Self will discuss all the day's stories, big and small. We'll hear from the National League of Cities in the United States and from our very own Henry Reese Sheridan, who is still writing us new letters from New York. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily, and I'm Chris Termack. I'm joined today by Chiara Ramella, Monocle's culture editor and deputy editor of Confect magazine, and by Alexis Self, Monocle's associate editor. Happy Friday night to you both.
Happy Friday.
I'm so glad that you said my name with a slight Austrian accent. It's the first time you've done that, Chris. I feel very flattered. Wow, what a Friday. This is gearing up to be for me.
I didn't realize that was Austrian. That's an impressive thing to call
with that little...
because I can't roll my R's. Us Austrians struggle with the whole rolling of the R's.
What's Happy Friday in Austrian German?
Fröhlicher Freitag.
Natürlich.
Do we have to do like a language revolving around how to say Happy Friday? You've both had a pretty busy week. Is it fair to say you're happy that Friday is here? It's a bit of a crazy week for Monocle magazine with deadlines and such and such and such.
Well, I think it's quite funny that when most of Europe the camps for holiday, and we like to celebrate that the camping to the holidays, Monocle just ramps up the publishing schedule. You know, we have to get those papers on the sound lounges. And so
exactly.
That's our job, and that's what we're here to do, and that's what we have just done. We're just putting the finishing touches on the summer newspaper, which this year is going back to its old moniker as Mediterraneo, because it's very much aimed at that kind of lovely Southern European sweet spot.
Lex, are you looking forward to reading Mediterraneo in the Mediterranean at some point in future?
I am going to Provence in August for a couple of days.
There you go.
A long weekend. And of course, I'll be grabbing a copy from the nearest kiosk and unfurling it by the pool.
Well, speaking of Mediterraneo, we will start one more time with Madrid, where Monocle's team from the Foreign Desk has been attending this week's NATO summit, talking with ministers from various countries about their role in the alliance. Today, we look at Greece, which occupies an unusual position as the only NATO member whose primary strategic concern, at least historically speaking, is not Russia, but rather another NATO member, specifically Turkey. Andrew Muller caught up with Greece's ambassador to NATO, Spiros Lambridis, and started by asking him what Greece could teach others about talking to Turkey at the summit.
Well, this summit indeed is considered by many as a historic summit. Why is that? First of all, because even before the beginning of the Russian invasion on the 24th of February, it was meant to be a historic summit because it's a summit where we're going to decide the new strategic concept. And of course, after the 21st of February, the agenda was altered somewhat. So it is historic because there's a lot of interesting discussions and decisions to be taken on the situation in Ukraine and how to deal with Russia in the future. It's increasing cooperation with China as well. The strategic concept, which is going to be adopted. And on top of that, of course, obviously as a result of the invasion, we have two new candidates. Totally unexpected.
But for you in particular, will you be meeting other NATO ambassadors, or are you spending time attending meetings with other Greek ministers and Greek officials?
Well, the program usually in this kind of summits is consisting of mainly the prime ministers or the president's presence, and therefore everything rotates around him. So all the ambassadors will be following their leaders. So my job is to follow the prime minister and be wherever he is and support him in every way I can. So that's how it's done. There's going to be three sessions and two dinners. So in those five opportunities, they have to discuss whatever they have discussed.
How much fun are the dinners usually?
The dinner tonight will be, I suppose, it's only heads of state and their spouses, a lot of fun, because it will be in the royal palace with the king and the queen and the spouses. Therefore, no politics, hopefully, and a lot of nice talking. It's, you know, finally, it's about time that we go back to normal discussions after the COVID. So probably tonight is going to be a nice opportunity for that. Tomorrow's dinner, however, is a very serious business. It's a transatlantic dinner, which means that all the members of NATO, plus those EU countries that are not in NATO, which is a total of 36 countries. And it's going to be extremely interesting.
A question you can try answering diplomatically. Do you pass on any advice to your other NATO ambassadors about how to respond when Turkey takes a stand on something, given Greece's long experience of Turkey deciding to take a stand on things? Is it best to try and meet them halfway? Do you just wait them out? Do you assume they'll get bored and calm down eventually?
They never calm down. As you said, we have a very long experience with that, but we learn to live with it. So lately, as you might have noticed, this government, is especially the Prime Minister, who's a very learned and very intelligent person, they're reacting very calmly to all of this. I mean, as you have seen, the rhetoric the last weeks or months has been quite skyrocketing from the other side, saying that illegally we occupy islands in the east part of the Aegean, islands that have a population of 40, 50,000, all Greeks, and we illegally occupy them. So normally a state would be in total alarm or hysteria out of this. We're very calm about it. Now, the poor Swedes and the Finns did not expect this to happen. So when they come to me, because we're good friends with their ambassadors, of course, and tell me, well, you have the experience of that. How should we behave? The only thing I can tell them, welcome to the club. Now you know what you're up against. Okay. Takes patience, logic, and insistence, like in every negotiation. But that's how it is. I mean, I cannot get in the shoes of the Swedes and the Finns. My shoes are straight enough to be able to cope with this kind of very difficult neighbor, I must admit.
That was Greece's ambassador to NATO, Spiros Lambridis, speaking to Andrew Muller. Still with me are Chiara Ayamela and Alexis Self. And while UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson was busy pushing for more defence spending at the NATO summit this week, here in the UK, his Tory party was rocked by yet another scandal. Chris Pincher, the Conservative Party's deputy chief whip, has resigned following reports that he drunkenly groped two men in a private club in London. Lex, Pincher has now been suspended from the party as well. Where does this scandal rank among the scandals of scandals past?
Well, let's first say that it's a very unfortunate name for someone accused of such things. But, you know, I mean, it's not funny. It's just so depressing. This isn't even the first time that Chris Pincher has had to resign for inappropriate sexual behaviour. Who are these people? I mean, honestly, it's just like beggar's belief. Five senior Tories have been investigated for serious misconduct since the middle of April. That's
just
like
since
six.
You just
can't keep up. It's like it's this constant whirlwind of scandal and chaos. Where does this rank? Well, I don't know. I mean, are these things relative? You know, we just had two by-elections, one because a Tory MP was convicted of sexually abusing a child, the other one because a Tory MP was stood down after being seen watching porn in the Houses of Parliament. So I don't know. I mean, you would think that the going to jail is obviously the worst one, but I don't know. It makes you despair, and it makes you hope at least that we'll reach some kind of reckoning where the electorate realises that these sociopaths shouldn't be in charge. But, you know, the alternative and probably more likely result is that people become even more apathetic and disillusioned with politics.
I feel like your mind is exploding on air as we speak, Lex. I'm glad you could get all of that out. Chiara, I do wonder from some of what Lex is talking about there, it does almost feel like, well, either we are getting immune to these sorts of stories. I mean, is our threshold for a juicy scandal dropping in some way, or is it just that the politicians seem to not recognize the anger among the public when these kinds of things happen?
Well, I have to say, when Lex talks about, you know, are we becoming more apathetic towards this, I grew up in Berlusconi's Italy. And so my tolerance for this kind of stuff is just different to, I think, the average Brit. I mean, I grew up in the 1990s Italy, where sexism was rampant and abuses of power were an everyday occurrence, and our prime minister was investigated on a fairly regular basis.
And did you just sort of have to shrug your shoulders?
Not that we shrugged our shoulders, but we just became accustomed to it just being the reality. And I think that it just changes the way that you understand power. And perhaps this is what I have brought to the UK with me. When these things happen, it's not that I'm not disgusted. I am disgusted, but maybe I'm not shocked because I expect a level of abuse of power to come hand in hand with people who don't have any respect for the job at hand and who have just interest in the power side of things. I think that it also beyond that is a sign of perhaps a political class that's inherited its behaviours from decades past that is not able to understand that, you know, the world has changed and that certain things that perhaps would have just been kind of rumours in the back rooms are no longer just rumours in the back rooms. They come out thick and fast, and reputations can't just, you know, be maintained by collective omity, but that these things do transpire. So I don't know. I think that hopefully a political consensus, a public consensus around the fact that these behaviours are not acceptable is building. But I just worry that perhaps a sense of overwhelmedness from the amount of terrible news and terrible mismanagement that has gone on in the past couple of years has slightly numbed people to just being, you know, they expect to be disappointed. And so they are just confirmed when they see these types of things, I think.
Well, Lex, perhaps the one difference here compared to at least some scandals is that Pincher at least resigned. Do we still think there is a tipping point where Boris Johnson could either accept some sort of responsibility for all of these scandals below him or those that he's himself been a part of, or will he be ousted at some point before the next election, do you think?
Well, the problem with the British system is that it kind of relies upon someone to have shame in order, because you have to resign, as we've seen. You it's very difficult to be forced out. You know, there's all these procedures and different parties have different ones. The Tory party has one that, and you know, Boris Johnson was able to survive a recent challenge. I think, you know, talking about the culture, I agree with you that, you know, these things have, this isn't obviously new, but I think the sheer scale of what's going on at the moment, I mean, you know, 56 current MPs are facing allegations of sexual misconduct. 56. And, you know, assuming that the majority of them are male, that's nearly 1 in 8 male MPs. Hmm. I think, and they're not all conservative, although the conservatives do seem to be particularly egregious in this area. I don't know. I mean, you know, I would think in a way Boris Johnson has learnt from the Trump playbook that, you know, rather than accepting responsibility for something, you just you know, you keep doing different things and distracting people enough that they kind of forget about what you've done before. You know, also taking responsibility and resigning are kind of the same thing, and once you do that, you are admitting culpability. And, you know, I think looking at Boris Johnson's past, professional and personal, he's not really in the business of taking responsibility for his actions.
And then you look at Pincher himself. You know, he has done this before. He he has admitted his culpability in the past, and then look at where he had gotten himself back to in 2022. So does, you know, admitting culpability actually correspond to any serious consequence? We'll have to find out.
And then just to go back to Berlusconi, you know, I think political parties that have one leader, and, you know, in the British and the Italian system, that leader can be quite powerful, you know, they rot from the head. And, you know, if you've got someone like that as your leader, obviously it's going to pervade the rest of the party and the culture. And, you know, if someone's not taking responsibility at the top, then you're going to think, well, why should I have to?
Just finally, Chiara, on that, by contrast, we now have Mario Draghi in Italy. Is Italy, by comparison, the more boring one now, or is it somewhere under the surface?
You know, I was quite shocked because I was in Italy a couple of weeks ago and I watched the news, and there was this, the huge scandal of the day was that the Movement Five Star had decided to divide, and Luigi Di Maio was going one way and the others were going the other. But it was all like internal divisions of politics, and it made me feel really strange. Like, there was no actual juicy bit of news to the developments. So who knows? Maybe Draghi has managed to bring his Super Mario-ness, his full-on central bank kind of demeanor to Italy. But it won't last long. It never lasts long in Italy. Come on, let's face it.
It never lasts long. Well, speaking of scandals and big news, let's cross over the Atlantic now, where between the Supreme Court and the January 6th Capitol Hill hearings, there has been no dearth of stories to talk about. One of the many rulings by the Supreme Court this week was on climate change. The court basically rejected the Environmental Protection Agency's right to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, saying that the Biden administration could no longer rely on a law from the 1970s, the Clean Air Act, as a basis for its climate change curbing actions. The ruling once again throws the federal U.S. response to climate change into disarray, not for the first time, and it also impacts American cities, which have really been at the forefront of tackling climate change for the past decades. To get more on this, I was joined a little bit earlier by Carolyn Berndt, who is the Legislative Director for Sustainability at the National League of Cities. I started by asking Carolyn about the immediate impact of this ruling for American cities.
I mean, you have to understand that cities have been facing the impacts of climate change on the ground in their communities every day, from droughts and flooding and wildfires and extreme heat. Cities and local leaders are really problem solvers when it comes to climate action. So this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't change that. Cities still have the authority that they have to take action in a variety of ways to address the climate crisis. And many cities throughout the United States are committed to meeting the Paris Climate Agreement goals. And that doesn't change with this ruling from the Supreme Court.
So if that part doesn't change, tell us a little about what does change. Presumably, the biggest part is simply the kind of federal support you're now going to be able to get. Is that really just about money, or is it about other things as well that cities get from the federal government that might now be in jeopardy?
National League of Cities has long called for a federal partner on climate action, and that's because cities can't tackle the climate challenge alone. They're relying on the federal government to establish those national policies that will help them achieve their climate targets. So what does change is how the federal government is going to take action. We've been calling for a national policy to reduce emissions across a broad sector of the economy. And the ruling is definitely a step back in terms of the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector. But what I think is fundamental here to understand is that the court said that the Environmental Protection Agency went beyond the scope within a particular section of our Clean Air Act. It did not change its underlying authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And we know that EPA is planning a future regulation to do so. So that doesn't change the way in which that regulation will be developed, and its scope is really what the court got at here.
To that point, I suppose, in terms of a response to this Supreme Court ruling as well, as you suggest, there are a couple of things that the Biden administration could now do. One is, through the Environmental Protection Agency, adopt new regulations that are slightly different, maybe with a different underpinning than the Clean Air Act from the 1970s. Another way, of course, is to actually push for some kind of federal legislation. This has also been, of course, the key problem in the United States, that Congress is deadlocked and hasn't really been able to adopt any kind of legislation specifically on climate change. I wonder what you're looking for there.
There is definitely a need for congressional action at this point. The bipartisan infrastructure law that was passed and signed last year does make strong strides in addressing climate change and resilience through a variety of programs and policies at the federal level and across all of our federal agencies, particularly transportation and clean energy sector. But there is definitely more to do, and passing legislation is the surest and most durable path to reaching clean energy goals. And so that is definitely one of the steps that we are asking for Congress. There's a number of legislation that's pending, including our reconciliation package, which has up to $500 billion or more to address climate change. You know, that's still being negotiated. That would be the largest investment in clean energy that we've seen in the United States. The path forward on that is uncertain, but definitely the federal government role in establishing those national policies and framework will really support cities in tackling the climate challenge within their communities.
The other thing that I can imagine has been challenging for cities is, aside from congressional inaction and pushing for action, as you were talking about there, it's just the fact that government in the U.S. continues to change, you know, especially in the last few years. Yes, the Environmental Protection Agency might have had some powers in the past. It didn't always use them under the Trump administration, for example. How hard has that been for cities to plan ahead with, you know, what kind of funding they'll have, what they can really do?
It always helps to know that there is funding for a particular project that's coming to communities. We have the transportation bill within the bipartisan infrastructure law that makes major investments in transportation, and that's a five-year investment. So hopefully setting the right path on these policies and the programs that will really move the needle on climate action in communities and help local leaders set the vision for how they can be more resilient in the face of extreme weather events.
Just finally, Carolyn, you started by talking about the fact that cities are at the front line of this, have been facing this for a long time. I wonder if you could just give a few more examples of how cities, separate from the federal government, are going about tackling climate change, what kind of projects they are able to put in place on their own.
We recently did a survey of 50 climate action, sustainability, and resilience plans that were all passed within communities just since the beginning of the year to help better understand the themes and the concepts that cities are taking. And the top actions there are energy efficient buildings, electric vehicles, optimizing waste operations, public transportation, and renewable energy sources. And these are all things that local governments can control within their own jurisdictions and set policies and make decisions on that will really, again, help move that needle in meeting greenhouse gas emissions goals, addressing equity and inclusion in communities, which we know has been highlighted from the coronavirus pandemic. So cities are really making progress, but it all goes back to having that federal partner and support so that we're not facing it alone on an uphill battle.
That was Carolyn Berndt of the National League of Cities there. Well, let's jump back across the Atlantic to the UK now, where linguophiles will have been dismayed by recent news that Sheffield Hallam University has become the latest institution to cut its English literature degree over a lack of government funding for so-called soft subjects. Does anyone here want to out themselves as an English lit major?
Definitely me.
There you go.
English lit.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a BA in English, which I got from Goldsmiths University here in London. I moved from Italy and I decided to make this choice for my life. And I'm very, very proud that I did. And I was very, very depressed at hearing these news this week, because I think that my English degree literally changed my life. But it should have taught me not to use the word literally. So I apologise.
No, but it did literally change your life. That's one instance where that word.
In that case, maybe it actually worked. We'll give you that one. Lex, I'm assuming you don't necessarily want to take the side against humanities and English literature, despite...
No.
What was your major?
I'm a history boy.
That sort of fits in the same category.
I wish I had done English literature. I mean, history, similarly, I'm sure... You know, the attack on English began, or English literature, with its kind of vocational or lack of vocational beneficence. And, you know, history is the same. But you still need to know what happened in the past, in the same way I feel like, you know, English literature broadens your mind and doesn't just help you when analysing poetry or literature. It helps you for many, many other things.
Quite the opposite. I mean, I did a full degree in it, and for me, it wasn't really about studying texts necessarily. It was about learning to think critically, to really deconstruct every single bit of information that you receive. And I think as a journalist, that has served me so much. Even potentially more than a journalism degree in many respects, because it really has taught me to interrogate reality, try to understand the meaning behind things. I think that's very, very powerful. And, you know, I would argue that there are plenty of disciplines that don't necessarily relate to literature directly that would benefit from such an attitude, because otherwise, if we just continue thinking that the only way of getting to a result is just to get the most well-trodden and confirmed route there, then is there any room for improvement? Is there any room for doing things outside the schemes? I think that even when I did my degree, there was so much, I guess, doubt back in Italy as to whether there was any point doing any humanity degrees. Essentially, none of my friends did. And I think it's a real loss when something like this happens. And at the time, it was just people's reticence because they themselves knew that it would be difficult in a climate of kind of economical uncertainty. But when the government is directly saying, you know, we don't really recommend funding subjects that don't yield at least 40% of people after a certain amount of time in what they call like highly skilled jobs, well, then that what does that tell you? What is a highly skilled job? How do you define that? Because is being a librarian not a highly skilled job? Like, how do you then define that? And what do you define as personal success? You know, I think that we're getting a little bit philosophical here, but a lot of the stuff that we do here at Monocle is about how you define your own success, you define your own quality of life. And for me, that's not necessarily measured in the amount of money that you make, but in the happiness that you have in the job that you are in. And I can definitely say that, yeah, sure, English graduates are probably never going to rank as top kind of earners, but they're also amongst the happiest, well, happiest, you know, depends how kind of, you know, existential they get. But they're amongst the most creative and, you know, genuinely satisfied with their jobs people I know.
Lex, just one final quick word on this, but I do wonder also if it's a case of sometimes, you know, students don't necessarily know what their vocation is going to be when they are 15, 16, and that is why you choose something like a humanities, because it's important to go to school, it's important to go to university, and you don't necessarily want to go into a science at that stage.
Education is wasted on the young.
you are sounding like such an old and wise man today, Lex.
I agree, and actually I think the American model is good in that regard, in that you know, minor in a few different subjects and you get a broad kind of panoply of subjects and you major in the one which interests you the most while you're doing the course. With English literature in the UK, I mean, you know, this is the problem isn't obviously English literature. It's, you know, the higher education system in the UK, which has become so much about money that, you know, they look at a metric and, as you say, they look at top earners and whatever, and then they deduce, which is the most useful degree to do. But, I mean, I think it's inevitable, really, this, given the kind of vanishing cultural prestige of the novel and its centrality to our culture, which is a shame, I think, but I think, you know, we can't really fight that, and it is becoming a kind of niche interest in
a
sense.
I really, really disagree with that because, yes, maybe people spend a lot of time on TikTok, but I've also really started seeing a lot more people reading books on public transport on my way home. And I know it's just anecdotal and it's just me and my tiny little bubble, but things are changing. You know, I go to Daunt Books and there are people in there. Every single time I go, it's always heaving with people just browsing the shelves. I have a lot of confidence in the fact that the book, the physical item of a book, is something that will just bring some degree of respite from so much of the horror that surrounds us. So I have like a huge degree of trust in it, and I'm not going to get dissuaded. It has to survive, and we have to keep studying it. So I don't know.
You're going to have to go and buy. You're going to have to go buy all the books in the wild and then just throw them at people.
Bulk buy War and Peace and see where that gets me.
I like that the two topics we've discussed today has drawn passionate responses from both of you in different directions, and that is good for a show. Lex, I know you're going to have to be going soon, but Chiara, we did I wanted to head to your home of Italy for one final bit with the panel. Venice specifically, it's always been this city that serves as something of a tourist attraction, and now it seems like it's embracing that identity by, well, literally charging entry to tourists just like any attraction would. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I think that Venice has been looking for ways to curb over-tourism for a while. And it's funny that so many people thought that the pandemic would be a time when this would actually, you know, be like a proper plan would be hatched. But actually, it looks like we're going back to the type of idea that they were playing with before the pandemic happened, which is this idea of just simply restricting access. Now, they're not saying they're restricting access. It's not going to get a top number.
There's no minimum, exactly.
There's no maximum of people who can access the city at any given time. But the idea is to start charging access from next year so that they dissuade people from going at the highest, I guess, times of the year, the highest season. But then you look at the cost of the ticket and it's between 3 to 10 years. So it's not exactly impossible to fork out that kind of money if you really desperately want to visit Venice. I think what's really frustrating and everything that and something that people who do live in Venice have told me for years now whenever I visit is that the problem is the people who go in a day, they don't spend any money, they go on a cruise, they hardly, if they buy anything, they'll buy just a sandwich for lunch. They hardly ever buy anything else. They don't actually bring any money to the local economy and then they just leave by the end of the day. So it makes sense to try and monetize those types of people because at the end of the day, the upkeep of the city is still, you know, a difficult thing. And the more over tourism comes, the more people don't live there and the more the local economy is depleted. So there has to be a way of monetizing the place in some respects. I get it. It's hard to have this type of conversation because you can say, you know, well, then you Disneylandify the place and you don't make it like a real place. But the place is not real. You know, it isn't.
It already has that.
And to me, I guess the organic solution, of course, in a wonderful world would be to encourage creatives and encourage workshops and encourage artists and young architects to go and live in Venice and live there year round. And there are people who do that. It's a wonderful organic way of building that type of thing, which I really hope that Venice is fostering. And there are actually, interestingly, there are really good universities on Venice Island that can do that. Most people then just move away, though. The only way of really turning Venice back into a real city is to have people who can feasibly live there so that you have less Airbnb, you have less kind of organic capacity for people to stay, though that doesn't necessarily always dissuade people. You know, that's a long-term project. But I do think that something has to be done because Venice can't die. And if it is kept, if it keeps going the way that it is, it will die. And it will be a tragedy because Venice dies when it becomes just a place to look at. And Venice dies when there's nobody who lives on it. Venice dies when it physically disintegrate under the ground of the people who go. The climate change is already threatening the city and it's getting flooded more and more. It needs help. And help, I guess, sometimes comes with money. And to me, it's something has to be done, and let's see how far they can push these initiatives and hopefully build a long-term plan that hopefully they have time to think about in all those months without any tourists at all during the pandemic.
Chiara Ramella, a love letter and rallying cry for Venice there, which is appropriate because finally today it is also time for our weekly letter from New York City. This week, Henry Rees Sheridan takes a trip down his own memory lane.
It's 2008. I'm 17 and living in Swansea, South Wales. My best friend, Sam, has just passed his driving test. We drive around in his Ford KA, treating pedestrians to the dulcet tones of the experimental rock band, Lightning Bolt. I'm studying for my A-levels, basically high school exams, at a big further education college on the outskirts of the city. The college was established in 1955 as a mining college, and it was still, when I was there, an ideologically lonely place to be a conservative. I know that because I knew the only conservative among the students. He was in my politics class, and we all called him Tory Boy. He lived up to the name with a comically old-fashioned comportment. He claimed to have got his manners and mannerisms from his grandparents who he lived with. One of the modules we had to study was US politics, and it was a good year to be studying it. It looked like America was about to elect its first black president, and he happened to be an exceptionally handsome and charismatic man. Also, he wasn't the only interesting thing about the race. Barack Obama's opponent was John McCain, a respected senator from Arizona. McCain was a relatively safe and boring bet for the GOP presidential ticket, but his running mate was not. Her name was Sarah Palin. She was a 44-year-old governor of Alaska, and she was picked by McCain to appeal to the religious right wing of the Republican base, a group McCain had failed to inspire. Her stomach-churningly folksy style made her an overnight media sensation. What Palin referred to as the mainstream media seemed to delight in holding her under the microscope.
And when it comes to establishing your worldview, I was curious, what newspapers and magazines did you regularly read before you were tapped for this to stay informed and to understand the
I've
world?
I've read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically? I'm curious that you...
All of them, any of them that have been in front of me over all these years. I have a vast variety of sources where we get our news to. Alaska isn't a foreign country where it's kind of suggested, it seems like, wow, how could you keep in touch with what the rest of Washington, D.C. may be thinking and doing when you live up there in Alaska? Believe me, Alaska is like a microcosm of America.
The election added color to the U.S. politics course I was studying, but it wasn't all pageantry. We also had to learn about the nitty-gritty of US politics. Stuff like the federal system, the Supreme Court, and the Constitution. The 1973 Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade was often used to illustrate these topics. It was ideal because it touched upon so many complex aspects of the political system in the US. It was used to illustrate how a decision by the Supreme Court could create new rights through an interpretation of the Constitution. And it was used to teach us about the federal system. We were told how states could formulate trigger laws, contravening federal law. These trigger laws would lie dormant until the higher law that they rubbed against was changed. We were also taught that Roe v. Wade was legally vulnerable and could be overturned. But at the time, the most prominent anti-abortion politician in America, Sarah Palin, was swiftly turning into a figure of ridicule on the national stage. It seemed certain that the future lay with Barack Obama's brand of centrist progressivism that appealed to Americans across demographic lines. All that was a long time ago. But the last week in US news has dredged up memories from that time.
50 years of a legally enshrined right to abortion in the United States has been brought to an end after the country's Supreme Court decided to overturn its landmark ruling made in 1973. It means that tens...
The momentous Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade feels like information I should be reading about in a textbook rather than on my phone. Women in the US no longer have a constitutional right to an abortion. The gravity of the consequences can't be overemphasized. Trigger laws prohibiting abortion have already come into effect in some states.
You have the power to elect leaders who will defend and protect your rights. And as the president said earlier today, with your vote, you can act. And you have the final word. So this is not over.
I've also been thinking about the people and ideas that were around in 2008, and about how everything that seemed solid then has melted into air in the 14 years since. Obama's centrist brand of democratic politics is on the ropes. It's deeply unfashionable among Democratic Party staff and activists, who are far to the left of the average American voter. And as a result, the Dems are hemorrhaging support from working class groups they previously relied on. After losing the 2008 election, Sarah Palin went on to become a key figure in the Tea Party movement, a loose configuration of right-wing Republican groups. Ostensibly, they were about fiscal conservatism, but in reality, the Tea Party came to oppose almost everything the Obama administration did. Several conservative commentators have identified the Tea Party as the beginning of the political movement that culminated in the election of Donald Trump. Of course, there are some fundamentals that have stayed the same between 2008 and now. This week, economists at JP Morgan Chase announced that the risk of a recession in the US in the next 12 months is, quote, uncomfortably high, unquote. So that's at least something, if you're of a nostalgic bent, to take comfort in.
Henry Rees Sheridan there. That is all the time we have for this edition of The Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists, Chiara Ramella and Alexis Self. Also thanks to Carolyn Burnt and Spiros Lambridis. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Lillian Fawcett and Isabel Rosen. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Chris Termack here in London. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Goodbye and have a good weekend.